We cannot let their voices stifle our cause. This political crisis puts our head in their jaws. History is upon us. We've seen this before. We can never allow freedom to exit our shore. Good afternoon and welcome to the Trump Chronicle. I'm your host, Ray Brookstein. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the most galvanizing factors of the MAGA movement has been caused by the relentless attacks on President Trump and against anyone associated with him. Frankly, the more they attack, the more we unite. Funny how that works. And thankfully, they don't fully get it. However, fake news has been front and center in this prolonged and protracted campaign to besmirch his reputation, abilities, spread information about him with the intent to ultimately remove President Trump from office. And as my Jewish mother says in Yiddish, which is kind of a combination of German and Jewish or Russian and Jewish, she would say, Gunish Helfen, meaning it's not going to work. So on Twitter, I came across a man and the cover of his books, which caught my attention. Actually, it stopped me in my tracks. One cover read, Is Trump a Liar or Is It Fake News? And the subtitle was The Little Red Riding Hood Test. And then on the other cover, it read, Did Trump Obstruct Justice or Is It Deep State Fake News? And again, the subtitle was The Little Red Riding Hood Test. So I was quite curious about this. I mean, I've read the fairy tale. It dates back about 10 centuries. And I sought out the author, Zach Maiman, to help me understand what in the world is the Little Red Riding Hood test and what does it have to do with answering these core questions that really do separate the left from the right. So I asked him to join me to help me understand what's going on. Zach Maiman emigrated to the United States from Russia in 1980. He has authored several books. He earned a PhD in mathematics and statistics from MIT. He's also a grand chess master or chess grandmaster and father and a grandfather. So welcome, Zach.
Thank you, Ray. I'm not grandmaster. Though my children think that I am
okay.
An old grandmaster. I am about a master. I didn't get few points to get national master in the United States.
I'm sure you could take down my king in about 5 minutes. So, Zach, you know, you're a mathematician at a very high level. I personally got as high as trigonometry. And you know, so to be at that level is quite staggering. And I guess what I'd like to do is to ask you in layman's terms, what is this Little Red Riding Hood test? And what does it have to do with the news we're hearing?
The question of truth and lie, for some reason, were very important for me since my childhood.
I see. These are questions
that tie up, that are very interesting intellectually and very interesting emotionally. You can kill any person with the scream, you lied to me, and that ruins relationship right away. People take it very personally if you accuse them of lying.
Yes.
And also there are very interesting intellectual questions with this. What is a lie? Are you supposed to never lie? Is joke a lie? And stuff like that. And I was thinking since I was a child about questions like this. And I talked to my teachers and I read all the books that I could get. It's a fascinating open-ended problem, like chess, like many other open-ended problems that are very interesting. Mm-hmm. And when I grown up, I wrote several children books about truth for kids and for teenagers, still thinking about it. My grandchildren read these books. some of them for small children, some and three of them for teenagers, with fairy tales, just trying to understand this concept that sometimes you have to lie. And when is it? And what is white lie? And is joke a lie? And when is a lie when you stay silent, when you don't say anything, it could be a lie. So questions like this I discussed in those books. And still, even after I wrote these books, these questions, I don't know why, but there are several questions that I'm thinking all my life about, regardless of how old I am. And this is one of the relationship between the truth and lie is one of those questions. So when people started calling Trump liar, that brought my attention. And I got interested and I started checking when did he lie? What did he lie about? And when I checked a few facts, it wasn't a lie to my understanding. And then I noticed that it's not just on TV, on CNN, on New York Times, but even people in my surrounding, I would go to a doctor or to gym, and people would, you know, once the name Trump comes up, people would always say, oh, he's such a liar. Even the people who support him. That was amazing. Even my friends, in one of the conversations, they said, oh yeah, he's a nice guy. Because, you know, at the beginning, it wasn't clear what kind of person he is. And I was watching him and I realized that he expresses kind of general public opinion. And that's what I liked his policy. I liked what he was talking about. And I realized that it wasn't just for this cycle that he was talking. I checked his videos. He was talking about the same things many years before. So he was a solid guy. And then one of my friends said, well, but he is a liar. And I said, when did he lie? And he stopped and he started thinking, and then he checked his iPhone and, you know, let me see. So that was highly unusual. It's like people know that Trump is a liar, but they cannot give right away one example of his lie. And I did some experiments. I started conversation on Twitter. I asked Twitter. I intentionally made my account on Twitter several years ago. I've been thinking about it for several years already. I made my account and I asked, can somebody please tell me an example of Trump's lie? And it was immediate attack. That, oh, of course he is a liar. Sure, there is no question. I said, give me one example. And they came up with, we can discuss it later on, with a ridiculous example, so especially after so many years. And I discuss it in a book. I can mention it, I guess, that he said something in Chicago while Obama was giving his speech. Several people were shot. And the answer was, it was a lie, and it's not that just people told me that it was a lie. New York Times, Washington Post, all major newspapers around the world call it a major lie, even though statistically speaking, he was absolutely correct. He just took the number of people that would be dead in Chicago in a year and divided it by 365, and that's how much in particular date people would die. And he gave this number. And but they came through the records and they counted and they said, no, on this day there wasn't so many people.
So they took it very literally.
Right.
Rather than really just try to take a look at what he actually said. Now, let me ask you, how do you apply this statistical analysis, or what goes into a lie? Like, I read in your book, and it was very fascinating, that you don't just stop at what is a lie, but what is the structure that makes something a lie? Can you comment on that?
Okay. Before even I do this, when I started writing, I decided to write the book, especially when I heard that one of Trump's people, very close to him, I don't even want to give his name, but a person who I respect enormously, when he was on CNN, And the interviewer said, but Trump is a liar. He didn't support Trump. He didn't say, he didn't stop the interview. He didn't rush out. He didn't say, how could you say that? He said, I only can respond for myself. That was strange. That even people who are around Trump, that's when I decided to write this book. And the main question, first, of course, you know, there are, as you know, there are databases with Trump's lies, like 10,000 lies in Washington
Post. Last I heard was 2,200, but maybe, I guess it's up. Yeah. It's grown a lot. I don't know how many that is per day, but that's quite a bit of lying.
There are different databases in New York Times, in Washington Post. And my first, I wanted to go lie by lie and analyze it. And then I realized that, first of all, it's too much work for me. But I could have done it if that's what it took. But then I realized that it wouldn't prove anything to anybody.
I see.
Because like in this lie in Chicago, you say it technically correct, in literally sense, but in fact it is a lie, intentional lie, but not Trump's lie. Trump of people who pretend that they don't understand what he means.
I see.
That's a lie. They certainly knew what he meant. Anybody would know that. And if I start producing some different sources, let's check this, especially in environment, his lies about this, about that, that would be an infinite conversation, and that's what they want, actually.
I see.
That, I call it, I introduce technical term, I call it shrapnel attack.
That's a good term. I mean, it.
It's clear, shrapnel, right?
People can understand what shrapnel is.
Right. It, in the sense that they would just throw at you many different nails and bullets and just, you know, something will stick. And if it don't stick, it will create such a noise that there is no way to defend. What against which bullet you're going to start defending yourself? Against, you have to analyze every bullet, every lie. So I quickly realized that that's not the way to go. And then I started thinking, in general, it's a general question, not just question whether Trump is a liar or not, but how do you convince anybody? How do you make your argument? How do you prove that you are right and somebody else is wrong? What are the principles? And surprisingly, it's not that there is developed science or approach to solving such questions. But after thinking for a long time, I realized that there are two possible ways of accumulating our knowledge. And it's very important for people to understand that there are two ways, because people don't distinguish it, that there are two ways. And the manipulators, the fake news, uses that we don't understand that there are two different ways of accumulating knowledge and intentionally mix it up and create confusion.
I see.
So first possible way to accumulate any knowledge in any science is just go brick by brick, build something, we learn something here, we add one more experiment, we add something else, and then eventually we gain some knowledge. And that's how many sciences operate, and that's how knowledge, human knowledge accumulates, and that's normal.
Okay.
And that's what they say, they refer to it, when they don't say it explicitly, when they say, when Mueller says, I couldn't make a conclusion whether Trump committed crime or not. As if he, in our mind, we think that that's how he worked. He found some facts here, some evidence there. He looked at everything around him. And then he said he can't conclude either way. But because in our mind, we don't separate these two opposite ways of accumulating knowledge. So yes. First way is just accumulated brick by brick. Second way is what I call... it's what I call Little Red Riding Hood test.
Ah, Little Red Riding Hood test.
And people use it. And people use, it's not that I invented it. people use it from ancient times. Trump certainly used it. I'll give you later on if you give me time. Yes. A great example when Trump uses it. And also something that I thought, and I essentially learned it, at least I was reinforced with Trump, I want to give him credit, that when you convince other people, you should work, I call it meta theory, you should work in meta space. You should go away of facts, of small facts. You can only use the facts that everybody agrees, that is absolutely clear, and that they are facts, not opinions, not what I call finger statements, because there are some statements that cannot be proven right or wrong.
And are you talking about middle finger statements?
Exactly, because there is, people say, people, terza non datum, you know, people say there is no middle. And that's why I said middle finger, no middle, because middle finger is in the middle. It's not, it's a statement that is not truthful, that is not false. There is no way to simply prove it. And that's one of the statements that, for example, is Trump a liar? If it's possible, and that's why they use it, if it's possible to prove that Trump is a liar, then or prove that he is not, then there is no question about it. Right. We proved it and we go home. The debate is over. It's exactly the statement that there is no way to prove it one way or another.
So it's it's almost an impossible thing to prove one way or the other.
Right, right. And that's by the way, there is an entire field of mathematics that I was surprised when I was a kid that there is so-called intuitionist logic. Not usual logic, but intuitionist or constructive logic, sometimes it's called, where it's possible to have where A or not A, not necessarily true.
So how did Little Red Riding Hood, because we know the story, what big ears you have, what big teeth you have, what big arms you have. So she was trying to get little facts to give her a clue as to whether or not this was really her grandmother?
Yes. In fact, bringing me back to the earth. In fact, if there are among your listeners people who know statistics, it's analogous to statistical hypothesis testing. That's the second way of acquiring our knowledge. It means this, and people do this all the time. We have certain, we make assumption about the world. In some areas, we call it null hypothesis. For example, our children love us, or our government is good, or we have capitalistic system. Some basic stuff, or that I'm healthy. And then if minor events happen that contradict it, we ignore them. It's not that, you know, something happens and we immediately have to start reevaluating all our life. Where did I go wrong? Maybe my wife doesn't like me. Something. No, we ignore them. Only if there is, because it's our null hypothesis. And that's intention.
That was a null, N-U-L-L, a null hypothesis.
N-U-L-L.
Okay, null hypothesis.
Null hypothesis, yes. It's our null. It's our understanding of the world, and it's cemented. It's our belief in the world. We don't change it very quickly.
On that note, we're going to take a short break.
As we say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
So So the second way of acquiring knowledge is to form null hypothesis, and then don't change it unless something happened, some red flag happens, or sequence of red flag. And it should be, the event should be so rare that we should say we have to reject or at least reevaluate our null hypothesis. That's the red little red Riding Hood test. And that's what she did when she came to her grandmother. She sees her grandmother in the bed, who invited her in the bed. She's in the bed with Wolf. She thinks it's grandmother. And her null hypothesis is that it is grandmother. But she feels uncomfortable. She doesn't want, something is off. She doesn't want to reject right away this assumption that it's her grandmother, but something is off. And she builds her rejection region with several red flags. And each red flag, she builds it in such a way to discriminate between Wolf and grandmother. For example, she doesn't say, oh, how nice, why do you have such a dress? Because that wouldn't distinguish between Wolf and grandmother. Mm-hmm. But she says, why do you have such big arms? Because arms are much bigger than her grandmother's arms. Mm-hmm. She is willing to listen to reasonable explanation. She doesn't reject right away that it's not her grandmother, but she is concerned. And Wolf gives her a couple of explanations. That's why, you know, he needs to...
The eye so he could see her better. Right.
And she goes on and goes on. And when she comes to big teeth, they both understand that that's it. That she hit the critical region and she is about to reject null hypothesis.
I see.
Because the answer is, you know, there are several major red flags. And that's the moment when Wolf kind of sprang to action and started eating her, swallowing. Because he knew that that's his cover is blown. There is no way, if she were Mueller, she would have said, I was trying to figure out, is it grandmother or Wolf? No. Her null hypothesis was that it was grandmother.
I see.
And she was trying to figure out whether it's not her grandmother. And she figured out. In what situation she would have checked whether it's Wolf, whether it's her grandmother. Suppose she comes in and she sees in the bed something that doesn't look like her grandmother. And she thinks it's a wolf. Then she gets a gun and points it at the wolf. And now her null hypothesis is that it's Wolf. Hmm. She still doesn't want to pull the trigger because, God forbid, it is grandmother. So her null hypothesis is a wolf. Prove that you are not grandmother. Then she would start asking questions. You know, what soup did you make to me yesterday? Or, you know, stuff that would discriminate between Wolf and grandmother. It would be a completely... Coming back to Mueller, it would have been completely different investigation.
So he wasn't, it didn't appear that he was looking to find truth or in what Trump was saying, but only guilt.
Right. It's right. It was his job. His job was to prove that Trump is criminal. There's nothing wrong with it. That's his job. That's job of you know, every prosecutor has to prove that it's criminal. He has to start with the assumption, with the null that, because he has to present his case to the jury. And the jury has presumption of innocence. The jury think that the guy is, whatever comes between them, that he is innocent. So the prosecutor should say, if he is innocent, then why this? Why that? Why his arms are so big, why his legs are so huge.
He didn't do that.
And that eventually jury will be convinced, yes. According to this Little Red Riding Hood test, he is not innocent, he is guilty. It's not that he's going in another direction. He's not saying, it would be completely different investigation if he said, let's assume the guy is guilty, I'm going to prove that he is innocent. In case of Mueller, and this is how I prove it to you, that it would have been a completely different investigation. And I'm going to use M theory as well. I'm going to use, it's an illustration of how to use this M theory that I call. First of all, I don't want to use any facts that are not known, that could be argued and stuff like that. I'm going to go into meta space. And some people say it's not rational. It is rational. That's how people think.
What is meta space?
Metaspace is get away from obvious evidence. That's where Trump lives, by the way. He only talks about facts that are well established, well known. He doesn't want to get involved in some, you know, paper was published a couple of days ago, a couple of years ago, and the result was such and such. He doesn't want, because that's very easy to confuse issues and accuse him of whatever they want, manipulate the knowledge.
So, for example, if he has data that there were a certain amount of new jobs that were created last month in the economy, he'll stick with that.
You can say, I'll give you... I'll finish with Mueller, and then I'll give you an example of Trump, how he uses theory, okay?
Yep.
With Mueller, one example, there could be several red flags, and I talk about it in my book, but one example that I don't even mention it, something that everybody knows, and I can prove it to you that he wasn't trying to prove that Trump is innocent. And here it is. Why didn't he interview Assange? The main idea was that in Russiagate, that Russians get into these emails and pass it along to Assange.
Right.
And this is the fact that it's not arguable. It's not under discussion. And he said it in his report. He stated it, but he said, based on some news reports, which is ridiculous for an FBI guy to say, based on some news reports, as if it is evidence. Based on some news reports, Russians contacted Assange and gave him Hillary's emails or Podesta emails. And why didn't you talk to Assange? One answer could be that it was hard to do because Assange wouldn't want to. No, Assange wanted to talk to Mueller. Assange offered not just to talk to Mueller. Assange offered to Mueller some technical evidence proving that his information didn't come from Russia.
I see.
And Mueller didn't meet with him. That's it. That's the proof. That if Mueller was trying to prove, assume that null hypothesis Mueller was trying to prove that Trump is innocent, then why didn't you meet with Assange?
Very true. And I wondered, you know, when he was, you know, all that time, and then he got released out of the embassy. I thought that was about the time when Barr came into the situation and started to evaluate the origins of the dossier. And I thought it would be a perfect time to interview Assange. Some people think he's a traitor. Other people think he had the key.
He should have interviewed it from day one. Once he appointed, he should have called Assange. Assange, you want to talk to me? Yes. Okay, I'll pay for your ticket. Come here. He should have done it day one. I've heard the theory that Assange was arrested to make him shut up after the close of Mueller investigation.
Unbelievable.
So that's an example how to use M theory with obvious fact in meta space, not discussing, you know, not... I'm not going to check what Mueller did, what witnesses he called, what documents he read, what interview he had.
That was all just to confuse.
Just the simple fact. It doesn't make sense. This test doesn't prove 100% never, like any test in statistical hypothesis. But in terms of human knowledge, it solves the problem. For me, it's convincing immediately. Wow. Because there is no other explanation.
Give me an example, because I do want to hear your example, and then I want to move to some other subjects. But give me an example of how Trump uses metaspace and that we don't even recognize it.
Sure. If you remember, there was debate, Republican debate, and I forgot who was asking the question. He said, your tax plan is terrible, it wouldn't work. And great economists said that your economic plan wouldn't work. You can fly from the stage flapping your arms if you're, you know, the same reason. And Trump, before that, he answered some, he gave some details. I want 15% tax rate and stuff like that. And then he got this great economist say your plan wouldn't work. He has maybe 30 seconds. What can he do? I might have go again through, I suggest this, and it based on such and such research, it would work and stuff like that. He cuts through, he goes into meta space, and he gives a reason that to many, that's why people thought that he won this debate. To many people, that was convincing. Hear what he said. If you think my tax economic plan wouldn't work, you have to get rid of Larry Kudlow, who is a great guy, who sits on your panel, and who said he loved my tax plan. That's it.
That's it. It's a simple.
Yeah, very simple. And by the way, what he does here, it's not that he's saying, he rejects, he doesn't prove that he's, again, what's his null hypothesis? He's not trying to prove that his tax plan will work. His null hypothesis that his tax plan is bad. Assume that my tax plan wouldn't work. It's terrible. Then why Larry Kudlow is sitting in your panel right here on the stage?
It's and like that's it. Flip-flopping it. It flip-flops the logic.
Right. So, but at least, and he goes for much weaker goal. He at least proves that it's not as absurd as you're trying to put it. We can argue about the details, but because you overshoot, you said that it's absolutely terrible and stupid, then why is Larry Kudlow here sitting? In your panel, you invited him. He's sitting here on stage and he said he loved my tax plan. That's it. That's meta space, meta proof right away. Red Beetle Riding Hood test.
You know, I want to move to another subject. And You were born in Russia, correct?
Yes.
And you lived in Russia up until you emigrated to the United States in 1980.
Yes.
So can you tell us what life, because I'm very interested in knowing what the we paint. I've grown up all along with, you know, the Cold War. With going into fallout shelters when I was a child, we had staged exercises where we went under desks. There was a real threat. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we grew up with this fear of Mother Russia. So a lot of the American mentality, and we saw it in the 2016 election, we saw it with the Russian collusion intervention, everything Russia, Russia, Russia. Is there basis in this, or is this another big lie? And what was life like growing up?
Okay, I'll answer these two questions, and I also throw in some bonus. I'll tell you what the lessons I've got from Russia's life.
Please.
That Americans don't have this experience, they don't know. What two major lessons, I'll tell you that. But first of all, life in Russia, it's the everyday life is it's the same like everybody everywhere else. You have family, you have your work, you have your hobby, you go to movies, you read. In Russia, people read probably much more than in the United States, and it's reading is a little bit different. Everybody knows best books. Here, nobody knows. You know, you different people would read different books. But in Russia, there are certain sets of classical literature that people would read. French, German literature, of course, Russian literature, American literature. People would read all Hemingway, for example. Jack London, I don't know if you...
I'm aware of Jack London, I'm aware of Hemingway.
Yeah, okay. Because Jack London, I think he was communist. That's why he was popular.
there were a lot of communists in the United States.
Yeah, I know. Theodore Dreiser, I'm not sure that I pronounced last name correctly, American writer. But there are many, a lot of American writers are very popular in Russia. Mm-hmm. But you cannot say that it is different than in any other than in Texas or Alabama or Connecticut. It's people are poor, of course, and but that there is some level that people adjust to it, and they spend practically all their income on buying food, for example, mm-hmm. and. In this sense, people are happy and they go to movie and they fall in love and then children are born, they get married. So on the surface, it's all the same. But there is some truth in that Russia is dangerous. Mm-hmm. I can make it's like this null hypothesis that I explained. If somebody asked me to prove that Russia is not dangerous, if somebody says that Russia is dangerous, I would immediately start arguing, no, Russia is not. But if somebody says Russia is not dangerous, I can make a case that it is. And here is the difference. Here, what I mean. Russia doesn't like wars. After World War II, in every family, there was somebody who died. Mm-hmm. My grandfather from my mother's side died. My father went through the war. It's a terrible experience, and people know it. 20 million or something of Russians died in World War II.
Oh, my.
So they're hesitant, on one hand, to start a war. On the other hand, if Russia were military as superior against the United States as the United States is superior against Russia, Russia would have started war with America. I have no doubts. Russia would have started war for world dominance, to bring communism, to free all the people. To some degree, that's what America is doing with weaker countries, which I don't like it, but that's what America is doing. So it's also, imagine that there are people look the same. They're nice and smiling, but imagine there are alarm clocks in they're standing on a desk. Dozen alarm clocks. They look the same, but one of them is a bomb. It doesn't matter that they look the same. They tick the same, but one of them will blow up. And the same way is here. Look, we have such a great difference in United States between Americans. That they're also all nice people like Romney or Pelosi or Mueller, but look how different they all are from conservatives and from Trump. And can you imagine there is much bigger difference between them and Russians, Russian communists, people who want to dominate.
That's the risk we see, is there seems to be a move towards socialism. I just want to take a quick break.
Patriots. Through his widely acclaimed poetry books, The Trump Chronicle, Ray Ray has preserved for us these historic events that have surrounded the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. His fervent and patriotic poems capture in real time what could have easily been lost or forgotten. The Trump Chronicle is available on Amazon or through the America Out Loud bookstore. Pick up a few of these memorable books for your library. They are a must-have for our MAGA movement. Let's support this important patriotic poet and show host so we can continue to read history through poetry.
So I was able to get to Moscow University, but then the policy against Jews, at that time there was a problem with Israel, between Israel and Soviet Union, and there were many scientists. It turned out that many Jewish scientists were working in military complexes, and they started. They wanted to immigrate to Israel, and that created problem for Russian government. And Russian government reacted. They stopped admitting Jews into universities. So I knew I knew that my children wouldn't be able to get to university in Russia. And that was a decisive factor, and that's why we decided to leave, even because there was opportunity. So I am immigrant, but I'm legal immigrant, and I want to say that
legal immigrant.
Legal, not illegal.
And amen.
And the difference between legal and legal, as I say, is difference between burglar and a guest. I'm grateful. I'm grateful yes. to all Americans. I remember when we came here, we bought our first, my wife went to work in 2 weeks. We never got any welfare, we never got any paycheck, nothing. And we tried to avoid it, even though at that point it wasn't, it's already started. My wife got started working without knowledge of any English in 2 weeks after we came here. She was a programmer. And I remember our neighbors, we bought our small house, our neighbors brought us furniture where, you know, for nothing. Of course, they didn't ask us to pay. We were so grateful to them. They didn't know us.
Wow, that's beautiful.
And it wasn't like furniture that people throw away, you know, just take this junk out. That was the furniture that when we moved to our better house, we took with us. And our children wanted to have some of this furniture in their rooms because it was beautiful, gorgeous furniture. We couldn't believe it. Other neighbors, which was also not, we understand now it's normal, they brought us chicken soup the first month. People don't do it in Russia. We were really shocked to, you know, very surprised. And also, in America, people are friendlier. There's not in New York. In New York, I quickly recommend, you know, we came to Lynn in Massachusetts, and people would talk on the street, say hello, and the same way where I live now, people who don't know each other would meet on the street, they pass by, they say hello. But in New York,
I tough place. I grew up in New York myself, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
I tell you this, I went to New York and I wanted to ask how to get to some street. And I came to one person, first time in New York, I came to one person and I started, excuse me, could you please, and the guy makes half a circle and goes around me.
I came to
a woman because I thought maybe, you know, I'm threatening. The woman, excuse me, could you please, and she does the same thing. And then I realized I came to a third person and say, how to get to 56 and 6th Avenue. And he stopped and explained.
Oh, my God. You know, it's really funny that you said 56 and 6, because that's where I had my office, on Avenue Americas in 56th Street, working for Connecticut General as an agent, a life agent. Unbelievable. I want to ask you, you were limited to the education that you could get in Russia. You're obviously at a high level to begin with, but you're talking about wanting to elevate it to a PhD, and that your children really would not have that opportunity. How did you get into MIT? You must have had an unbelievable resume.
When I came here, I wasn't a PhD, but I had published several papers already. I worked with Kolmogorov, who is, I don't know if you know him or not, that's a famous mathematician who founded probability theory. Passed a lot of exams already, and they were able to transfer some of this to here. But I came to MIT, I came to a professor, and I said, I want to, you know, get PhD if possible, but I don't have much time because I have two kids, and, you know, can I do it in a year? And he said, no way, but we can try. And the worst, maybe, and the best year of my life.
Of course.
All the exams, the general exam. I had to write my PhD thesis, which was based on new results. And all of this, while my English, even now, you can see that it's not perfect. But at that time...
Your English is fine. I mean, obviously, you have your accent, but your English is perfect, really.
Then, you know, I had to go to classes. It was a very, very tough time. But I did it. Sometimes, you know, when you're against the wall, you do certain things that you wouldn't do otherwise. I wanted to tell you two lessons that I learned from Russia that one thing before even I say it, sometimes I feel, and you already mentioned it, you started this, that you were going to the left. I sometimes feel that I came from your future, from American future, so to speak. That you are moving into direction from which it's like back to the future, I feel. I already been there. I lived through socialism, through communism, first stage of communism. I know what it is. I know when there is no free market, when there is no property. I know when everything is regulated. I know people don't want to work hard because they are not compensated enough. And that's, and everybody, I know about equal pay and all, and single payer healthcare. It's terrible. It's disgusting. It's impossible to explain how bad it is. And you are moving in this direction every day. And I can see you're moving in this direction. Even worse, Russia to this day, they wouldn't let foreigners, illegal immigrants to come in. They would just shoot them.
I understand. I mean, I can't imagine us being able to jump a fence in Russia.
Right. There's like
you die. You get shot.
You get shot. And that's, by the way, you can think that I'm bloodthirsty. That's the only way. Because look, if somebody stopped me on traffic light and I start to run away, policemen can shoot me. They have guns. If they can, you know, they can follow me, there is always risk that they can shoot me. And I know that they shoot sometimes people during traffic confrontations.
Wow.
If I start, you know, pushing my right or something, or make some brisk movements or something, they can shoot me. I know there are cases like this, but not with illegal, you cannot shoot them.
What was the other lesson, Zach?
That wasn't a lesson. It was just a beginning. There are two lessons. One is that I have a unique experience knowing that the entire country can lie. Americans don't have this experience, and they don't. They think when CNN and Washington Post and, you know, all the media is saying something, there must be something true there. It's hard to believe that there is intentional lie. Or when they talk about professors or Nobel Prize winners or intelligence community or 10,000 former prosecutor, you know, there is always this organizational letters against Trump as if it means anything. And for many people, obviously, it means. But not for Russian, who came from Russia and knows that the entire country can lie and it's okay, it's normal. That's one lesson. And another lesson is that it's not that they're mistaken, because I try to argue with people when I, at some point, I woken up and I wanted to argue with them about this. For example, why did you get into Czechoslovakia with war? Look, talk about peaceful people, peaceful Russian people. Czechoslovakia wanted to get away from Russia. They moved tanks in there. And it was 68, and I argued with my fellow students, why did we do it? And there is no way to convince them. And I thought there's something wrong with me. I'm not making good argument. Maybe I should say, think of this, say this. And then 91 happened, 1991. And people, the country, you know, woken up someday, and suddenly it's not socialism, it's capitalism. There is no Soviet Union, there are just 12 republics. And what do you know? All these big socialists in a day became big capitalists. All these big money people, billionaires, they're former socialists, former communists. They didn't need any persuasion. So the same way is with these people. It's not this business for them. It's not that they, you know, they're confused or they don't know the truth. It's just business. You think Romney doesn't know that Trump didn't collude with Russia? He knows. But it's convenient for him to say it, so he's saying it.
Unbelievable. Can you talk about anti-Semitism that seems to be growing in our country and contrasting it to what life was like as a Jewish mathematician?
I may shock you with what I think about it, because I know that this is something that goes against current understanding of what anti-Semitism is.
Okay.
And what about the whole racial thing? I should say at the beginning that I believe that the right approach is that all races, all nationalities should be equal.
Absolutely.
In some sense, they are not equal. Maybe they, you know, they're different. And also people don't want to recognize it. But the different nationalities may have some advantages in physical advantages or intellectual advantages. So something in some game, it's okay. It's normal. But I don't think that I don't care if people say anti-Semitic things. And I think it's okay. I care only if government does some anti-Semitic things. Because that I cannot avoid. With people, so I'm not, I really, when they scream this, guy is racist. Now, in America, it became really, somebody calls you racist, it's like a comma. It's like, you know, just breathe in, breathe out, it's nothing. Everybody, whatever Trump says, he's racist. Whatever the person who supports Trump says, he's racist. Now, even when Pelosi wanted to say something bad against her fellow member, she's racist too. So it means nothing. When people say really racist thing, you can avoid those people. But when government does racist thing, you cannot do anything. And
are you seeing any evidence of that in our country?
Don't you?
I do. I mean, okay, we're seeing it with the freshman congresswomen from Minnesota.
Well, yeah, but she's still saying that it's not policy.
Right, true.
It's okay, let her say it. She's stupid, she's an idiot. Let her say it.
Okay.
It, unless it becomes policy, and there is policy. For example, there are quotas for different races to different universities. Sure. There are quotas on jobs for different races. There is so-called affirmative action, which people don't want to argue about and don't want to, you know, it's not politically correct even to question this. But if you think about it, it's racial policy because you want to give advantage to one race over the other, regardless of individual.
Well, we're seeing that at Harvard.
Exactly.
With the Asians.
My all two children were able to get into Harvard.
Wow. But
my next child, he had perfect SAT, and he was on waiting list in Harvard, and he couldn't get into it. And I know that there are entire slice of population that get into Harvard with lower SAT score.
You know, I want to just shift a little bit in the last few minutes that we have, and. And ask you, and then I would like to read a poem that I wrote, because you mentioned in your book and in our talking privately that there was a very famous poet called Pushkin in Russia. And I kind of chuckled because, you know, I write poetry. I think you've read some of my stuff.
Yes, so. I like your books. I read them.
Thank you. Well, it's a nice plug. And I also read your books. And I have to read them again because I'm not a great reader and they are a little complex, but you've helped me simplify some of it. But we will make sure that your books go on to our America Out Loud platform. When we do our show, I'll make sure that the books in the Amazon code names are there so people can get a hold of your books. But I want to ask you, what's in store for America as you see it?
You know, I thought that I'm thinking that America is done. In fact, I am trying my best to keep it from falling down the toilet, but I think it is done. The good news is that I thought the same way about Russia before I left. I thought that Russia, Soviet Union, is completely dead body. No communication, no freedom, nothing. Never, nothing can ever come from it. And then 91 happened, and then Russia is reborn. So who knows? That's who knows? Maybe America could be saved, but it require it requires our energy, force of all people to fight it, and I don't see it. It's like Hitler is not, it's the idea in America, at least, would say that there was good Germany and then one bad guy, Hitler, and then that's why it all happened. There were bad Germans, people who were silent when he was rising. And now the same way is happening here. And so I appreciate what you're doing with your, you know, your, maybe it's small step, maybe it's small.
It's having a voice. And that's why we're here.
It's making waves. It's waking waves. And maybe somebody will listen. Maybe something happened. Maybe not. I doubt that something will happen. But you're doing whatever you can to put America back on the right path. And to some degree, when I write in my books, that's my idea too. I'd like to do something to still to prevent it from going down.
Well, I hope you do. And I know you have other books, and I'll try to get a hold of the other books. And I just, you know, before I read the final poem, which was interesting because you talked about that you are that you kind of are the future. You came, you know, and my poem is called It's Deja Vu All Over Again. But before I read it, I just want to thank you for coming on. And I'd like to have you on again. As time moves forward towards 2020, if you would oblige us, we'd like to hear your voice back.
Anytime.
Thank you. So it's called It's Deja Vu All Over Again. They say that Trump colluded to steal the votes away. The Russian bear intruded, spoiling Hillary's glory day. The Cold War hasn't ended. It's heating up indeed. No different than the race to space. Perhaps uranium increases speed. We paint them as the boogeymen, just like on Halloween night. Wooden dolls are nesting. Must be the Trojan horse inside. Some curse the name of Putin, but on the other hand, we're making deals behind closed doors, assisting Mother Russia land. They helped us on the Eastern Front, squeezing Hitler's frozen troops. But a communist's a dirty word. That's what we learned in school. It is a world community, so let's reach out with our hands. It's time to stop confusing us about their insidious plans. I think of my descendants who grew up in the East. I still enjoy a Polish Russian vodka kielbasa feast. Please put aside hysteria. In spite of what is said, red is still a primary color, not a place to dread. And on that note, love Ray Ray and a poem.